Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Never far from the front lines in that war is the state of Israel. It is under attack as we speak. And to discuss the nature of the attack, who is mounting it, and why, I'm very pleased to say we have with us one of my distinguished colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, our senior fellow and director of the Project on Global Antisemitism and the U.S.-Israeli Relationship. His name is Dr. David Wormser. It's great to have you with us, David. Thank you, though this is not a happy day. Give us a situation report, as you would say in the intelligence business.
About a month and a half ago, you started seeing this ramp up of escalation and rhetoric and outright calling for escalation and a huge uprising from the Palestinian Authority, that's Abu Mazen, the quote moderate, as well as then from Hamas, and then obviously from the Turks and the Iranians. And this escalation has been going on for a month with increasing riots and attacks on Jews randomly. It was called the TikTok Antifada because Arabs would randomly attack Jews and tape it on TikTok and send it around. But now
And compete, as I understand it, for followers and likes and that sort of thing as well.
Absolutely. And they were doing this all at the behest of the Palestinian Authority, which the United States is trying to re-enter into a peace process.
And essentially to resurrect as a serious player in the Middle East after the Trump administration more or less wrote it off, right?
Precisely. So it was definitely a pre-planned, strategically decided upon escalation by the Palestinian Authority. So what happened was over the last month, there's been this great escalation that yesterday escalated to the point where Hamas sent rockets onto Jerusalem, 7 of them, a new version of a rocket with a much, much larger warhead. And also it penetrated on some level the Israeli air defense systems, the anti-missile systems, which is a question that needs to be examined as well. One person.
This would be the Iron Dome system specifically, I assume, right?
Yeah. The Iron Dome. Now, the Iron Dome goes up to about 40 kilometers, and Jerusalem is just outside of the 40 kilometers. It's worked until now, but it really is it's the David Sling system that should have been activated. And that's a question whether it was. But nevertheless, the rockets got through. There are injuries from that, mostly shock. But today or overnight and today, there are waves and waves and waves of rockets. We're probably close to about 400 rockets by now that are hitting the southern cities of Ashkelon and so forth. There are fatalities there. There are numerous injured. So this is very lethal and dangerous. At the same time, the Antifada, the TikTok Antifada, goes on with attempts to stone and block Israeli cars and then lynch their inhabitants all throughout the country. There have been riots in every major city where there are Arab populations in Israel, Haifa, Jaffa, Ramla, and so forth. One hospital had its emergency room invaded by rioters and destroyed, and another wing destroyed, and the hospital had to be evacuated. It is literally a situation out of control. This is a very different war than any Israel has fought since 1948. It is a bit more reminiscent of 1948 than it is any other war.
So, David, let me make sure I understand this. The situation that has, I think, pertained mostly in the years since 1948 is that Israel proper has been secure, except for essentially terrorist incursions into it, most of which have been greatly diminished, if not stopped, by the construction of a wall separating the West Bank or other Palestinian areas from Israel proper. This would seem to be a case where Arabs inside Israel itself are engaged in these kinds of actions? Am I reading that right, or what's going on?
Yes, you are. You're unfortunately reading it right. And that is also in large part from the incitement of an Israeli party, which is in the parliament, the Joint List,
Arab party, which, of course, belies the whole argument that Israel is an apartheid regime, doesn't it?
Yeah. Not only do they vote, but they serve in parliament and they use the platform in the parliament to call for Israel's destruction. If the Israelis, if anything, are perhaps a little too lenient on the democracy side on this, most countries have allegiance oaths to take office in a parliament. At any rate, this party is calling on Arabs to rise up and protect Jerusalem as well. It's that
protect Jerusalem, meaning attack the Israelis, not protect Jerusalem from the attackers that are now.
That's exactly right. From the Jews is what they're saying. And that real incitement is particularly aimed at another party, an Arab party that took the position in this current round of we need to be a normal party in Israel. Enough with these nationalist statements. We need to enter a government and participate in the parliamentary system so we can get crime down. And so this is really
that's a first, and obviously very much anathema to the rest of these Arab parties that want to bring down the country.
Anathema, and exactly, it's anathema and a deep threat to them and their traditional leadership position, which was Arab nationalist. So they're a target as well here, that Arab party. And probably, unfortunately, in this round, successfully. So that will complicate, if not terminate, the ability of the anti-BB bloc to form a government. So I think this killed off the chances of having a government in Israel stood up after this election round, and probably Israel will go for fifth round of elections now.
But if that happens, and obviously we don't want to see this, what you call intentional escalation, in an important paper that you've done for the Center for Security Policy at its website, securefreedom.org, titled The Anatomy of an Intentional Escalation, Israel's Approaching Hot Summer. If that election takes place, David Wormser, against the backdrop of this kind of violence inside Israel proper emanating from enemies within, in a word, it presumably would result in the mandate at last for Bibi's government that has been missing for the previous four rounds, do you think?
Well, it certainly will shift the dial rightward, which can only help Bibi. Bibi himself may not go up that much in strength because there is a lot of frustration among many on the right that he hasn't been more he's been conceding an awful lot to prevent this escalation in the last weeks, including preventing Jews from coming to the Temple Mount, canceling major national ceremonies, and even postponing Supreme Court decisions over land ownership. He's conceded a lot to avoid this. And there's a lot of frustration on the right in Israel that weakness has provoked this even further.
And it's got to be, to some extent, the weakness that they've seen out of the United States in terms of its support for Israel. I've got to believe that's a factor in all of this too, including the perception of the Iranians as to what they can get away with, which is a subject we'll discuss a little bit further with the next guest, Khan Coughlin, right after a short break. But David Wormser, thank you for your time today and for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us again next week if you would. Next up, Khan Coughlin of the Daily Telegraph. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined for the first time here at Secure Freedom Radio by Professor John Ellis. He is a distinguished professor emeritus of German literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He has authored some 10 books, including Literature Lost, and most recently has written a very important piece for the Wall Street Journal entitled, Sorry, Professor, We're Cutting You Off. It talks a little bit about his own personal experiences in academe, and we're going to also hear about what he thinks is going on more broadly within our universities and, I assume, elsewhere in the pedagogy institutions of our country, because it now seems to be endemic. Professor Ellis, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you with us, sir. So give us a little bit of the flavor of the kind of environment you found yourself in as you were professorially engaged with both students and colleagues in modern university life, specifically at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
Well, I've been in the business for a very long time. My first faculty appointment was 1959. And so I've seen the whole progression. When I started, you could just sense the influence of the Second World War. In other words, there were professors who hadn't just gone from being a student in the classroom to then, you know, changing place in the classroom to the front of the classroom, holding a lecture themselves. These people had been out for 6-7 years in the real world, in a very brutal real world. And they brought to the academy maturity, common sense, practical wisdom. It was a splendid time for
life experience.
And I think people educated in those times really appreciated what happened to them. I was one of those, of course. Now, over the next, 30 years, I would say, the left built up slowly a preponderance on the campus. At the beginning, I mean, late 60s, there was a Carnegie Commission study that found that there were 3 left-of-center professors to every 2 right-of-center professors. Now, that sounds, you know, really amazing by today's standards. But over the next 30 years, that changed and became 5-to-1. Took 30 years for that to happen. Now, once the left had achieved that kind of preponderance, of course, then it was pedal to the metal. They had total control. And you see then the buildup accelerates very rapidly. So within the next 5 years, it goes from 5-to-1 to 8-to-1, and it's racing ahead now. It's about 15-to-1 now. But if you look at the junior ranks, assistant professor, an associate professor, that's to say the most recent hirings, the ratio is 50-to-1. So that tells you that even though it's really very bad today, it'll be a lot worse tomorrow. It's, in other words, it is so bad you think it couldn't deteriorate. I'm telling you, it is going to deteriorate. It's going to get even worse.
And 2 things that are particularly important to note about that, Professor, it's not just the ratios. It's not just the obviously worrying trend. It's that the intolerance of the left towards that endangered species among them is profound, is it not? And secondly, the quality of the education that is being imparted to the students is demonstrably degraded as well, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, of course, the motive behind this buildup of leftism is intolerance. It is a desire to stamp out any contrary opinion. And of course, partly it's due to the weakness of Marxism as a position. I mean, Marxism cannot stand up to scrutiny in the real world. It collapses everywhere when it's tried. And as a theoretical position,
except by the force of the gun, which enables it to persist, right?
But even that doesn't hold. In the Soviet Union, even that couldn't hold it together forever. The people wouldn't put up with it. But basically, there's another rule of human behavior that says when you put 10 people who all agree with each other in a room and keep them there and insulate them from any opposition to their viewpoint, they'll get more extreme. The position that they start off with will get goofier and goofier because they all agree with each other. So there's no opposition. There's no discipline to keep them on the straight and narrow. So they'll indulge in more and more fantasy. So the leftism on campus gets goofier and goofier and goofier because there's no pushback from anybody. And that's what's happening.
And if there were any corrective, it would be attacked relentlessly, and I think you've had a taste of that in your own experience, of course. Speaking of goofy, and I don't want to make light of this because it's deadly serious what is being done now in terms of the curricula and the prominence being given to so-called critical race theory in academia today, and whether it's welling up from the professoriate or whether it's being imposed by, you know, the state in some cases or school boards in other cases, it does seem as though this is now becoming an indoctrination program to hate not only the country, which I think has been a hallmark of the left for a long time, of course, but your fellow students and your countrymen and women more generally.
Yeah. Well, look, this is an example of goofy ideas that developed on campus. Now, this has been going on the campuses for about 20 years. No one took it very seriously. It's a cowardly thing on the part of the powers that be on campuses, because everybody knew what was going on in Black Studies departments. Nobody wanted to invoke the anger of the people who were doing it, so they just sort of thought to themselves, oh, let it happen in those classrooms. It won't go anywhere else, and we'll just ignore it and hope for the best. Now, in fact, what's happened is it's the campus walls now. But what's happening is that generations of miseducated students are going out into the culture, and they are they're sickening and poisoning the entire culture, because they've been poor, very badly educated. So now there is a climate out there in the culture at large where these goofy ideas from the campus can actually now get a foothold and get a hearing. And CRT, critical race theory, is one of them. Defunding the police, that's been on campus for 20, 30 years. No one ever thought it would be taken seriously. It was radical sheep nonsense. But because you had this outflow of students indoctrinated with radical leftism for the last 20, 30 years, you had this fertile ground created for these dopey ideas from the campus. CRT is the latest one, and it's the most serious and damaging one. Now, fortunately, I think it's so stupid, it's creating a backlash.
It is, and that's a heartening thing where it's taking place. But I don't know that if it is taking place around the country, it's taking place in enough areas to allow this, you know, country to be spared the consequences of the sorts of indoctrination that are clearly going on, not just in our schools, of course, but now in government agencies and, you know, the public space.
Well, this, of course, is where it was a disaster to have the Biden administration voted in, because the Biden administration is pushing this as an instrument of federal policy. But look, there's one thing that really gave me a good feeling, which is that the Chinese American Citizens Alliance of Greater New York, they issued a statement calling critical race theory a hateful, divisive, manipulative fraud. Now, that was very, very nice to see that. Right? Asian Americans recognize that this is complete nonsense and destructive.
I fear that it may be in part because they're not the race that is being favored in this thing, but they're also being subjected to a lot of enmity, we're told. So it's helpful to have anyone defying the conventional wisdom here that has now emerged. But, you know, Professor, I just have to interject something here, if I may. One of our colleagues, Jeff Nyquist, was educated up the road from you at the University of California, Berkeley. And back in the day, he recalls being told that with the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, communism is dead. The only place you can find a Marxist any longer is in the professoriate. He said, that's a disaster. Look at what it will do to your country if it happens that they get to, you know, mold the attitudes and the thought of our kids. And here we are a few decades down the road, and sure enough, that's so.
Well, no one should be in any doubt. The radical left, which is basically means the Marxist left, has a stranglehold on the educational system of the country at the moment. It's a dreadful situation. It's a huge threat to the nation. It's poisoning the national culture. I mean, the whole cancel culture thing derives from the campus. critical race theory derives from the campus. The denial of free speech that's going on, the censorship, it starts on the campus. But the public has got to rise up and say, we will not put up with this university culture any longer.
Let alone pay for it. That's maybe the place to start. Professor, this is a subject to which we would very much welcome a chance to return with you soon, because we do need to apply the antidote to this toxic syndrome. And your clarity about it, both here and in the pages of the Wall Street Journal recently, is deeply appreciated. And I hope we'll have a chance to visit with you. And again, we're talking with Professor John Ellis, the author of The Breakdown of Higher Education, How It Happened, The Damage It Does, and What Can Be Done. We'll visit with you again soon, sir. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with somebody else right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and a pleasure to say we are joined by Con Coughlin. He is the highly regarded defense and foreign affairs editor of the Daily Telegraph in the United Kingdom. He is a world-renowned and highly acclaimed expert on the Middle East, among other topics. He is the author of numerous books, including Saddam, His Rise, and Fall. He's a man we've not had on in an altogether too long time, and we're delighted to have him back. Con, welcome. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Great to be with you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
A lot to talk about in your portfolio, but I thought we'd focus on two topics. One in your area of particular expertise, the Middle East, and one on the other side of the planet. Let's start with Iran. From your perspective, Con, as a scholar and close observer of foreign policy, both that of your own country and that of ours, what do you make of what the Biden administration is doing with respect to the Islamic Republic of Iran at the moment? And what do you think of the implications?
Well, the way I see it is you know, I always try and understand what is going on in the mindset of the Ayatollahs, because, I mean, that's a $64,000 question. And I think if you're sitting in Tehran today and you're looking at the Biden administration, what you see is weakness. You see a desire to revive the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, at any cost. And I think from Tehran's perspective, you see an opportunity to carry on with your clandestine nuclear program, knowing that the new Biden administration is not going to be in any way challenging. And I think the first thing, if you remember, Frank, the first thing that Biden did when he became president was to take Yemen's Houthi rebels off the designated terrorism list. Even though we know that the Houthis, backed by Iran, are primarily responsible for creating the humanitarian disaster in Yemen. But Biden did that as a goodwill gesture to Iran. What did Iran do? Iran announced it was enriching uranium to yet another higher level, taking it very close to the threshold required for building nuclear weapons. So, you know, it's not just my view of the sort of rather weak approach of the Biden administration. You can see from the way Iran is reacting to the new presidency that it thinks it has all the advantages.
Indeed. You know, Con, I'm so glad you mentioned the bit about Yemen, because in addition to the removal of the Houthis from the terrorism list, of course, the Biden administration also saw fit to remove the Patriot missiles from Saudi Arabia that had been used with mixed effect, to be honest,
to defend against the sorts of rockets that the and missiles that the Houthis were shooting from Yemen into Saudi territory. And that has continued. Indeed, I think it's intensified. So all of this suggests, as you say, a low regard, shall we say, for the Biden administration, the United States, under its leadership. And how do you think that's likely to translate into the prospects for, well, war with Israel, presumably, and perhaps others, by an emboldened Iranian regime or an increasingly alarmed group of American allies who fear they're on their own and must act to stop that nuclear weapons program from reaching fruition?
Well, I think the prospect for a further escalation in tensions in the Middle East is very probable. The thing is, there is already a war going on, Frank. There's a proxy war going on in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Yemen. Iran is constantly trying to undermine Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. I think the bigger concern for the West, if the West still exists, is that because there is yet again a failure of American leadership in the region, and of course the region experienced this under the Obama administration, what happens when this occurs is that countries that regard themselves as allies of the West start to look for new friends, and they look towards Moscow and they look towards Beijing. And so, you know, when I travel to the Gulf area now, they don't want to be rude about Beijing. They don't want to be rude about Moscow because they feel they might need them one day.
And indeed, to some extent, they seem to be welcoming those states into the region and making separate pieces, perhaps, with them, which is ominous, to say the least. And to your point, I've not heard it quite said that way, but it's definitely important to contemplate. Does the West still exist as an alliance of nations in the free world, I guess you mean? And it's a very, very weighty question, which actually is a perfect segue to the second topic that I wanted to ask you about, the subject of a piece that you wrote for the Gatestone Institute recently, Con Coughlin, and that is China's endeavors to bring about the end of the so-called Five Eyes alliance of members of the Anglosphere, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and I'm missing one. Who am I missing? The United Kingdom, of course. There you go. Great Britain. So, Con, talk a little bit about China's game there as a sort of microcosm of the larger problem of which you just spoke.
Well, the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance was set up at the end of the Second World War, primarily to defeat the Soviet Union. Its origins were defeating Nazi Germany and Japan. And then after the Second World War, a more formal alliance enabling these five countries to share intelligence was set up. Fast forward to today, and the primary goal of the Five Eyes network is to protect what remains of the Western alliance from threats posed by the likes of Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. Now, in the history of the alliance, the one weak link has been New Zealand. And as you're probably aware, New Zealand has had a very sort of green agenda when it comes to nuclear weapons, and it's been tolerated. And frankly, the only reason New Zealand is in it is because its geographical location makes it a great listening post for the Pacific area, and particularly for what's going on in Beijing. But New Zealand has a very left-wing, what I call woke government under Jacinda Ardern. And they've decided in Wellington that New Zealand's interests are better served by having trade deals with Beijing than fulfilling, supporting the Five Eyes Alliance. And this came to a head fairly recently when the Five Eyes Alliance wanted to issue a joint communique denouncing Beijing over its attempts to suppress democracy in Hong Kong. And New Zealand decided they didn't want to sign up to that and said, you know, they didn't want to jeopardize their trade deals.
There's the separate piece at work.
And Beijing is rubbing its hands with glee because, you know, they found the weak link. And if they can pull New Zealand out of the Five Eyes Alliance, then, you know, that is quite damaging.
A lifetime ago, I was in the Defense Department, as you may remember, at a moment when that bit about nuclear weapons caused a huge row with the United States because the government at the time, also leftist, declared that unless we declared that vessels were free of having nuclear weapons aboard, which many of them had at that time, they would be unwelcome in New Zealand's waters, and it was a very difficult pass. I think in the end we seem to have patched it up for most of the intervening period, but it's clearly the case that Beijing is making huge inroads in undermining that relationship now and exploiting the divisions. Where do we go from here, do you think, in terms of the Five Eyes arrangement and again to your larger point, the integrity of the West as a counterweight to Beijing?
Well, funny enough, since I wrote that article for Gatestone, it seems it's had quite an impact down in Wellington. I mean, I've done some interviews with New Zealand radio stations, and I think the New Zealand people were taken aback about precisely what was going on diplomatically. And since then, two things have happened. First of all, the Australians have kicked up a fuss saying, you know, we are in the midst of a really brutal trade war with Beijing. And it is not very friendly for you to say you're not going to support Five Eyes and do your own trade deals with Beijing. And there was a meeting between the respective premiers. And as a result of that, you've seen New Zealand backpedal a bit and say, well, actually, you know, we're not very happy with what Beijing's doing with the Uyghurs. We're not very happy about what's going on with Hong Kong, and Five Eyes is quite important. So I'd like to think that this is an example of you know, journalism actually having an impact.
Yes. Well, yours has often had an impact over the years, Con Coughlin, and this is one of the reasons why we're very keen to be in closer touch with you. And I appreciate both your time today, your insights on these two very momentous topics, Iran and China, and very much look forward to the kind of impact that you can have with us and our audience, among others, in the days ahead. In the meantime, thank you for joining us today and for this bracing bit of, bad news on the one hand and potentially some positive news on the other. And we'll look forward to more of both, I guess, with you in the future. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us soon. Thank you. Next up, we'll speak with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, about other aspects of that China threat, what it means for all of us right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, welcome back to all of you, and most especially to our next guest, a man I've come to admire tremendously, both for his extensive and distinguished service in uniform of the United States Navy as an intelligence officer and ultimately as the top intelligence officer for the Pacific Fleet of the United States, and also for what he has done since he took off the uniform, notably with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with what I think of as the real one here in Washington, D.C., but also his work on behalf of raising awareness about the threat that preoccupied him when he was in the Navy and that should preoccupy all of us these days, namely that of the Chinese Communist Party and what it is up to, what its ambitions are. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, and we call him Kimo, and we're always delighted to have him here
Thank you, sir, for joining us. It's good to have you back.
Great to be back, Frank.
You have been following closely, obviously, throughout your time in the Navy and since, Jim, what's been going on in terms of the astonishingly productive buildup of the Chinese Navy and its shipbuilding program that's making that possible. There was recently an event in which Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, marked the launch of not one, not two, but three major combatants, basically simultaneously, at Hainan Island, a major Chinese Navy base. Talk a little bit about that as illustrative of this larger issue of the speed with which we're watching the Chinese build the largest Navy in the world.
Yeah, Frank, it was on the 23rd of April, the 72nd anniversary of the establishment of the PLA Navy, that Xi went down to Hainan Island and commissioned these three warships. One of them was a Jin-class ballistic missile submarine, their fourth one that's gone operational. They commissioned a Type 075 amphibious assault ship, which is about a 40,000-ton amphibious assault carrier, if you will. And then they commissioned their third Renhai-class cruiser, Type 055. And they've got eight of these that will be finished here in the next year or two. And these cruisers are the most powerful cruisers on the planet today, with 112 vertical launch tubes that can launch land attack missiles or anti-ship cruise missiles. And these cruisers now are escorting the Chinese first two aircraft carriers as they operate out into the Pacific. And so we saw here in April and May, first carrier go down and operate east of Taiwan with this cruiser and six total ships. It's just like a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier strike group. Now, their carrier isn't as good as ours, but the fact is they have all the piece parts now. They have frigates, they have cruisers, escort cruisers like a shotgun. They have the carrier, they have resupply ships, and they're operating at sea. And in this case, they operated east of Taiwan as the PLA Air Force is conducting penetrations into the Taiwan Southern Air Defense Identification Zone, crossing the center line in the Taiwan Strait, and really ratcheting up the rhetoric about Taiwan and what they will do to them. That carrier then went down to the South China Sea, and then after about 3 weeks, it came back, and the second carrier went down. And so you have this continuous presence now of aircraft carriers from the Chinese down in the South China Sea. And this is just going to continue to grow as their third carrier is under construction. And we expect, given that they have eight of these Type 055 cruisers, at least eight carriers will probably be built here over the next decade. But in the in-between period, what does it say? It says to Taiwan that they are now not have to just worry about a threat coming from mainland China with missiles and aircraft and amphibious forces, but now they have to worry about aircraft carriers are on their east coast, you know, being protected by these cruisers and submarines that we don't hear too much about anymore in the PRC press, but the Chinese submarine force is still very active. And so what it says to Taiwan is you're surrounded, and what it says to America is you're not going to have access to defend Taiwan, at least outside of the second island chain, because they're going to be operating and controlling inside the first and the second island chain, in my estimation, with the force structure that they're building.
And those island chain references are to kind of the way that certainly the Chinese and arguably all of us need to think about the strategic array of forces, capabilities, allies, assets, geophysical, bases and power projection opportunities in that region. It will determine who controls the vital waters of the South China Sea and, you know, perhaps the future of not just Taiwan, but Japan and Guam and the Philippines and more. And so when you're looking at all of this, Captain James Fennell, you are looking at an inexorable threat that is growing by the day and that is most immediately, it seems, aimed at the island of Taiwan. How would you characterize the degree to which that threat is now really perilously close to being able to exercise an option for an invasion of the island of Taiwan by the Chinese?
Frank, I think, you know, one one metric that can help answer that is just in the first 4 months of this year, the Chinese commissioned, that's not produced, but they were already produced and tested at sea, 14 combatants. And the United States Navy only has commissioned one. So in 4 months, they've commissioned 14 and the United States Navy one. And the United States Navy has already said, well, we're only going to commission seven all year. So the Chinese have already doubled the amount of commissioned warships that the U.S. is expected to produce in this year. And they're going to do more than that. It'll, on average, for the last 5 years, it's been four to five times as many as the U.S. Navy. So the volume of tonnage and anti-ship cruise missiles and battle force missiles, if you will, that are being produced by the PRC Navy is logarithmic. And it's going to create a situation where unless there's something drastically done on the U.S. side to catch up or at least mitigate this growth, I think at some point, you know, Beijing is going to put the gun right up to Taipei's head and say, either you comply or we're going to blow you away. And it's not a way that they're going to just destroy the whole island. They're going to be able to come in and use precision weapons to defeat the Taiwan military and be able to preserve the things that they need there. Because we all have been reading about, you know, Taiwan produces all these semiconductors of this high quality that, you know, basically fuel the global economy. And China doesn't want to destroy that. So they're refining their plans to be able to conduct such an invasion, launch such an attack, but not destroy those critical infrastructures that they need in order to keep their economic machine going. And I have no doubt that they're working on that. And so the question is, what are we going to do to throw sand in their planning gears?
Right. And Jim, I wanted to thank you for your contributions to an important white paper that our Committee on the Present Danger, China, of which you are a very important member, put together about 2 weeks ago. It's available at presentdangerchina.org, and it talks about the threat to Taiwan, the need to end the policy of strategic ambiguity that we believe is contributing to the possibility of a Chinese, maybe a miscalculation, but military action against the island, and steps that both the United States and Taiwan can take to increase deterrence of that sort of attack. So, Jim, thanks again for your help with that. And please check this out, folks, because it's really a to-do list of what we can undertake now to try to stave off a very, very bad outcome if the Chinese do act. Jim, let me turn quickly to one last thing. We've only got about a minute and a half, so we won't do justice to it, but we'll start the conversation with you about China and biological weapons. There's reason to believe that they may have been involved in a biological weapons program when they let loose this coronavirus. What are your concerns about more generally what they're up to in this domain?
Yeah, Frank, this release here by the Australian newspaper this last week about this Chinese language document that was found called The Unnatural Origin of SARS and New Species of Man-Made Viruses as Genetic Bioweapons. This kind of is, you know, got a lot of people's attention. Because it appears that you've had this retired now colonel from the PLA wrote this paper in 2015, if you will, so about 6 years ago, well before what we're experiencing now. And they're talking and discussing about how biowarfare and using things like the SARS pandemic to use that in a way to achieve their strategic goals.
Yeah, against us specifically. Jim, we are hard out of time, but we have to come back to you on this very, very important topic, and we will next week if you'll indulge us. Thank you for your time today, my friend, to come back to us, as I say, on this and so many other issues on which you're really expert. Captain Jim Fennell, God bless you, my friend. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.